Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest adventure, the latest, greatest revelation of mysteries from life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, I see that you've been bigging it up again, this time in the Sheraton Grand Park Lane, drinking cocktails, and you had a particularly special suitor with you.
Oh, I did. There's nothing secret about it. I'm sure people are gossiping. They saw this, what shall I call myself, a middle-aged woman.
No, a woman, Miss Jones, a woman.
Cavorting with an extremely handsome young man.
Mm, that's true.
Who turns out to have been my son. Mm. But, you know, people's tongues wag. We did get a lot of attention from the waiters and waitresses,
right,
in the Sheraton Grand. It's a kind of palm court style tea room, like the ones you get in New York hotels.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
Very, very glamorous.
I went to a tea room like that. It was the Waldorf, actually.
Oh, yeah, they do a lovely tea there. Do they still do a tea dance there?
Well, I don't know. A couple of politicians in my distant past got caught out at the tea dances at the Waldorf, you know.
Oh, yeah, I bet they do.
That's where they're fooling around with people who weren't their wives.
But
why was there an occasion for you to be there in the first place?
Last year, my son took me to a hotel just off Whitehall.
What is your son, full name, please?
He's called Henry Shine.
What is his job? What's his job?
He is an actor and a singer. And he gave it to me because he couldn't think of anything else to give me for my birthday present. Mm-hmm. And it was so successful, mm-hmm, just the two of us, because I have two daughters as well, mm-hmm, who are very feisty, very loud. They dominate the conversation. Mm-hmm. Henry is gigantic. He's 6'4" and well-built and not a shy, retiring wallflower by any stretch of the imagination.
Yep.
But
yep,
when the girls are around, he doesn't get a word in edgeways. And he also doesn't get much of my attention.
I see.
So because this was so successful last year, he decided that he's going to do this every year for my birthday. Isn't that lovely?
Isn't that fantastic? Yes, that's great. Good. And was it just tea, or did a slight tincture pass your lips?
We may have indulged in a little champagne.
Very nice. That's good. I'm glad to hear it. Talking about that, and talking about the fact that your son Henry is an actor and all that, what do you think about the redistribution of money by the Arts Council to send more from the South to the North? And I have to say, I was quite pleased to hear this. I'm a northern boy myself. I'm from Chester, the northwest of England. And I've always thought that the South East, and London in particular, gets too much money from the Arts Council and the North doesn't get enough.
I agree with your latter statement there. The North doesn't get enough. But I think there's been a bit of misreporting here, because I had a look at it, you know. This is a huge amount of money. This is £43.5 million,
yep,
every year for the next 3 years to all these people who are going to be the beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. But it's up and down the country. This is not just the North. It's 78 designated towns and cities,
yep,
and venues such as the Royal Opera House, which we know is in London, the Royal Shakespeare Company, which is also in London,
yep,
and then you've
London
got
and Stratford, smaller... actually, sorry to interject there, but of course there is a Royal Shakespeare presence in Stratford upon it.
Yes, indeed there is, yeah, but also a library in Gloucester Library,
yep,
and the Stanley Halls, which is a performance venue in southeast London. So this money is going left, right and centre. It's not just heading north. Mm. I think Biggins, who has said on television how angry he is about it, doesn't want to go to Manchester.
We're talking about
he's missing the
Biggins
point
here, are we?
Christopher Biggins,
yeah,
yes. I think widely known as Biggins.
Yes, that's right. I thought he was awful. I saw him on television and he was asked about it by the invigilator who was interviewing him. And he said, well, you won't get me going to Manchester. And I thought, you blinking snob. You know, how dare you make out that Manchester's not a place where there should be donations and grants towards the cultural heritage of that great northern city?
I absolutely agree with you. I think, you know, backing art, culture, creativity right across the country is long overdue. And we should be doing it. Yes, we're in a recession. Yes, the cost of living crisis is tearing us all apart. But you can't let the arts go, because the arts is what separates us from animals. Human creativity has to be bolstered and boosted and encouraged. And the young people going into the arts, you know, they have to get a career from somewhere.
Yeah.
So I think it's absolutely right that we're backing this.
Oh, yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, one of my best friends, as I let everybody know, the millions who listen to Life on Planet Porky, is Mr. Bill Kenwright, who has been a friend of mine for the last 25, 30 years or so. He's the chairman of Everton, but he's also, of course, the world's most successful theatre impresario. And needless to say, when the lockdown happened, the West End closed down, all that, very, very hard times for people in Mr. Kenwright's business. And we never knew whether it would ever come back to life again. But I think it is coming back to life. And I think that the fact that people have missed it for a couple of years means they're going back at it now with great vigour.
Well, do you know, my son, who graduated from ArtsEd, which is the Performing Arts College in West London in Chiswick, which the patron is Andrew Lloyd Webber, graduated last year. He has not stopped working all this year.
Excellent.
He was in Panto at the beginning of the year. He then did a tour of Italian cities over 4 months.
Yep.
He had 3 cruises back to back, then went into the recording studio, and now he's about to start Panto again this year. So, you know, touch wood, if Henry's doing it, there's an opportunity for many more like him.
Yeah,
he's only 25.
Yeah, good.
And you know, we have to keep feeding the generations.
Well,
otherwise we will lose the arts.
Well, that's right. Well, I hope Henry becomes very, very successful in his chosen career, so successful that he will be able to afford to you a very glamorous lifestyle in the autumn of your life, Miss Jones.
I'm nowhere near the autumn, but very sweet of you to say so. But B, I don't believe in becoming a burden on my children.
You wouldn't be a burden. If he had loads of money, the first thing he's going to do is do what all kind of rock stars and successful actors do. They go and buy their mum a home. That's the first thing they do. Haven't you been reading the books?
Well, yeah, of course. But, I mean, I've got my own house, haven't I? So
yeah.
It could go either way.
No,
I could end up with Henry back on my doorstep.
No, you'll buy a bigger one. Don't worry. Now, talking about the arts, of course, I got sent a book last week. I'm so thrilled. I haven't read it yet, but I'd look at the first few pages. It's called Abbey Road, NW8. It's written by David Hepworth. It's the story of Abbey Road, the world's most famous and probably most prolific and most successful recording studios, which, of course, is in North London near Maida Vale. And I've started picking through it. Abbey Road isn't just the Beatles, although, of course, they're most famous for it because they named one of their most successful LPs after it. But I didn't realise that people like Elgar, the man who wrote Land of Hope and Glory, Ken Dodd, and even Pink Floyd all used it almost as much as the Beatles. But, of course, the Beatles overshadowed everything, didn't they?
Well, primarily because they named an album after Abbey Road Studios, which wasn't known as Abbey Road Studios in the days of the Beatles. It was known as EMI Studios.
Do you know what? I looked that up as well. It was EMI Studios, North London. It was never...
Exactly that. Never Abbey Road.
Even though it's on Abbey Road, obviously, that's all it was known as.
But it became known as Abbey Road. They became known as Abbey Road Studios because the Beatles entitled an album. But David Hepworth is a really good friend of mine.
Oh, yeah.
He's a good guy. Yeah. I've known him since he and Mark Ellen were the publishers of Smash Hits magazine.
Mm-hmm.
They'd been co-presenters of the Old Grey Whistle Test after Bob Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And they present this wonderful podcast called A Word in Your Ear. And they brought it to life last summer in Holland Park as A Word in the Park. And I was one of their first guests on that. There was myself, Danny Baker, and Gary Crowley. Oh, and Mark Lewison, the Beatles expert.
Yeah. And did they all contribute to this book?
No. This was a live version of A Word in Your Ear.
See,
so we were interviewed on stage by... by Mark and Dave Hepworth. It's a funny thing because David's got a sort of grumpy demeanor. He sort of walks around like a kind of fed up old bloke,
yeah, you know,
but he's not really like that.
Yes.
Mark Ellen's much more lively and sort of boyish and very smiley, and they're always incredibly pleased to see you. But David Hepworth always has a bit of a frown on his face, but he's wonderfully knowledgeable about the music industry and he's actually rather fun on the inside. Mm.
Yeah, well, that's great. Just let me read you a little bit from this that I've got. On the evening of June 6, 1962, Norman Smith, formerly a wartime glider pilot, right, then a skilled engineer at EMI's Abbey Road Studios in North London, saw that he was assigned to work on a test recording, which was effectively an audition for a new band. He was surprised to see that George Martin, then a senior executive at the Parlophone record label, was going to supervise it. A few minutes later, four young men walked through the door. Bang, the rest is history. That was the start of it. That's not bad, is it?
Amazing, yeah. I think that there were logs kept, you know, assiduous logs of all the artists who came in and out those famous doors.
Sure.
I've actually been in both Studio One and Studio Two. Studio Two is huge.
Studio Two is where they did most of it, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I've sat down at that piano that John Lennon played, and there's a wooden microphone hanging over the top, and so on. Some of their instruments and equipment is still there. But it does have a sort of hallowed feel to it. It's like going into a cathedral, you know, where the walls are sort of.
It is a musical cathedral, yeah.
Yeah, the walls are imbued with. Sort of births, deaths, marriages, christenings. It's the musical equivalent of that. Yeah. And you really do feel the presence of ghosts.
Oh, I'm sure you do. What I haven't found in the book yet, and I'm sure it'll be in there, is, and I read this somewhere else, I might have even read it in your brilliant Lennon book, Who Killed John Lennon, Miss Jones, was that at the time they were supposed to go to India because the LP was going to be called Everest. And they were asked to go to it and literally have their pictures taken on Mount Everest. And all four of them individually said they didn't want to go. You know, they couldn't be bothered or it was too much effort or they'd had enough because Abbey Road, of course, was the last LP they made, even though Let It Be was released later. Abbey Road was the last one that they got together to do. And it was Ringo once again. You know, Ringo came up with Hard Day's Night. Ringo came up with 8 days a week and all that. Ringo, they were sitting there and the photographer was saying, I don't know what to do for a picture. And Ringo said, well, why don't we just go outside and take a picture in Abbey Road? And the photographer thought, that's not a bad idea. And, of course, they went out and then they walked across. And apparently that's how it happened.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. These things that become iconic symbols, they always happen quite by accident.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, old Ringo doesn't get half the credit he should get, should he, for doing all that. Now, Miss Jones, we've got to get more serious, I'm afraid, now, because we're talking about, you know, legends there and a legendary place. Politicians are always in the news. And since the last podcast we made, we've heard that there was an attempt on the life of Imran Khan, the former Pakistani president and leader who's fighting and battling to try and regain control of his country, but somebody tried to shoot him and kill him. That happens quite a lot in Pakistan, I'm afraid.
Well, weren't you great mates with Benazir Bhutto?
Yes, I was, yeah.
What happened there? How did you meet her?
Well, her father had been the leader of Pakistan. Can't remember his first name now, but it was obviously Bhutto. And
Mr. Bhutto,
yeah. Mr. Bhutto. And I think he was hanged. Yeah, if I've got that wrong, I apologise to our millions of listeners, but I'm pretty sure that's what happened because he was, you know, he was leader of the country and then there was a revolt against him and a bit like King Charles I, really, you know, those who'd supported him said that he'd been corrupt, all that, and all that. And he died, and I'm pretty sure he was hanged. So if I've got that wrong, as I say, I'm sorry, but I'm sure I'm right. So years later, a decade later, his daughter, Benazir Bhutto, who'd been a very successful student at Oxford University, where many of the world's leaders' children are often sent to be educated, you know, including from Libya and lots of states in Africa and all that kind of stuff, you know, India and Pakistan. She got interested in politics and decided, you know, she had enough support to go back. So we got a tip-off. She was going back from Gatwick on, believe it or not, British Caledonian Airways. I don't know if you remember them, but
I do. I used to have one of those bags. You remember when airlines gave away sort of little tote bags that you could carry on board? Sure. I had one of those blue ones with a long strap.
Yeah.
With British Caledonian on the side.
Well, for some bizarre reason, it was British Caledonian Airways. I got down to Gatwick. There were a couple of other reporters who got onto it as well, but many didn't arrive before the plane took off. And I got in with Benazir Bhutto's people, and we got on the plane, and I ended up sitting next to her. And she's a very beautiful woman, by the way. I mean, you know, not in...
Oh, she looked like a Miss World, an Indian Miss World, didn't she?
Absolutely.
I know she was Pakistani before you all write
yes,
in.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, but you're absolutely right. And highly intelligent. And I got the seat next to her. So, and the flight to Pakistan's quite long. And
now, how much money and who did you pay it to to get that seat next to her?
Believe me, I just did a bit of talking and a bit of hustling like you do and all that kind of stuff, you know, and ended up sitting next to her. So by the time, you know, we were 2 or 3 hours in the air, I had my story. But in those days, there was no way you could file it from an aeroplane, you know. You can these days.
So you didn't sit there and interview her and write it all down?
Well, I just sat there and talked to her, but I had enough in my head to be able, if there was a way then of getting the story out of the aeroplane, which you can do these days with a laptop.
Yeah, of course you can, yeah.
Flight technology and all that kind of stuff, you know. So I just wanted to get to Lahore, where we were flying to. And the plane landed in Lahore. I remember one thing. When we landed in Lahore, first of all, we landed and everybody said, huge security operation. And then the door opened, you know, like, yeah, no, they turn around, they open the door. And the wave of heat that came into the plane blistered my face. It was so hot. It was about 42 degrees or something, you know.
It blistered your face.
It blistered my face, honest to God. You know, it was like a wave of... I thought, like, the plane had got on fire or something. You know what I mean? It was amazing. And then we got off the plane. There were a million people in Lahore to meet Benazir Bhutto. And, again, I got on her lorry. They have these lorries all decorated in flowers, you know, and all this.
Like the one Imran was on the other day.
That's right. Absolutely. It's a thing in Pakistan. And it took about 2 or 3 hours to get from the airport to the Sheraton Hotel, brilliant hotel, really great hotel, which was only about 10 miles away, but it took 3 hours because of the crowds there and all that kind of stuff, you know. And every year from then on, when she was alive, I got a Christmas card from her. Whenever she was in Britain, I always got a notification from her people, you know, if you want to come and see Benazir, and it was amazing. And
what, seriously? So you guys hung out, like, you kind of pulled you pulled her?
No, I didn't pull her. I mean, you know, she just saw me as a, I think, because I worked for the Daily Express and I was on the inside of the media in this country, as a useful contact, you know.
Come on, she fancied you.
Well, she probably did. I mean, you couldn't blame her if she did, obviously. But, I mean, I resisted.
Did you fancy her?
Well, no red-blooded man couldn't fancy Benazir Bhutto. She was beautiful, you know. I mean, literally, and spoke so eloquently.
Oh, what a shame. You could have been the consort of the president of Pakistan.
Well, I could have done.
You'd probably be dead now.
That's what I was about to say to you. The problem is that Pakistani politics usually end up one way. You either get hanged or you get shot. And very, very sadly, and I have to say, I was really upset, she got shot. And she got assassinated by her own security guards when she was out on the campaign trail for the next election. It was horrifying to think of a beautiful woman like that suddenly having her head blown off, you know, by bullets and all that.
It makes you wonder why Imran Khan was ever determined to become the leader himself, doesn't it?
No, not really, because remember, he was a huge hero. He was a great cricketer, obviously. He was captain of his country, Pakistan, when they were one of the top teams in the world. He was also one of the most eligible bachelors in the world. He married Jimmy Goldsmith's daughter, didn't he?
Jemima Goldsmith,
that's right. And but I think she was about 20 years younger than him. Like, I mean, no.
I've got a good story about that.
Yes, go on,
well,
tell me.
Yeah, because when I had my son, we were just talking about, so this is 25 years ago, and it was in the Portland Hospital, which is a private hospital just off Baker Street.
It's where the royals get born, isn't it?
A few of them do, yeah. Some at the Lindo Wing in St. Mary's Hospital, but the Portland, traditionally a place where celebrity babies are born, of course. Yeah. And in the next room to mine was Jemima Khan giving birth to their son.
Wow.
And they were having the most almighty row. This poor woman had just had a baby. Mm. And, you know, you're a bit vulnerable when you've just had a baby, you've got to say.
Yeah.
I've done it three times.
Yeah.
You're not at your best. You do feel quite sort of weak, and you don't really want somebody yelling their bloody head off at you.
Yes.
And this is what he was doing. They were having the worst row you'd ever had.
Golly.
Literally just after the baby was born.
And do we know what it was about?
No, I can't remember, but it really was not nice. It was unkind. Yeah. And uncalled for. I lay there quite surprised that none of the nurses or the sisters went in and said, "Oi, you, you know, get out, because she's, you know what she's just done, and she doesn't need this stress." Yeah.
No, I totally agree. That sounded like a not very nice situation. On a brighter side of life, Miss Jones, I read a terrific interview with Louis Tomlinson yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
He's from One Direction, isn't he?
Used to be One Direction. Yeah, they're all out.
That's
now,
right. But he's now gone off on a single career. And so often when these great boy bands break up, you know, the stories afterwards are all about, you know, how shocking it was and how depressed they all were, and they all went away and, you know, fell to pieces and all that. But he told a story of having a really successful individual career and how he and Harry Styles get on, the other great sort of personality from One Direction. And seems to me One Direction was A, very successful, and the lads who've come out of it have come out of it very well.
I think the secret of that is the fact that because they all made their name on The X Factor, I think everybody knows that, but they went into The X Factor as solo artists, solo singers, and the band was put together by the production team on what did I just call it?
The X Factor.
Yeah, so they didn't apply as a band. They didn't know each other before.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So they all, they all came to it with very strong personalities, strong voices, a little songwriting ability, and they consolidated their talents as a group, and they went very far, as we know. Mm. And then subsequent to the group splitting up and them all going their separate ways, they've blossomed. Each one of them has. Yeah. I think, was it Zayn Malik who was the first one to leave the lineup? But then you've got Liam Payne, you've got, as you mentioned, Harry Styles, Louis Tomlinson, all very successful in their own right.
Yeah, that's amazing. So Simon Cowell must have put it all together then, because he ran
this. Well, Simon Cowell has a team. I think he comes in and sort of glosses over it at the last minute. Yeah. But they do have a team.
Yeah.
A creative team who make these things happen. And it might have been because, you know, they had categories, didn't they, in those days, where you had your solo female, your solo male, your girl groups, your boy groups, your over 35s or whatever they were, your oldies. Yeah. And maybe they lacked a credible boy lineup. Maybe they looked at these four and went, wow, you know, the impact of these four fantastic looking boys with their singing ability and so on. We can make something of this. The thing about The X Factor, it was always very contrived.
Was it?
You know, you could always almost hear ticking away the formula it's a cash grab, isn't it, really?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll accept that. I mean, Simon Cowell's been very successful, hasn't he? Both musically and professionally, and certainly financially. So I can accept that. Yeah.
Yeah. They will have made an absolute fortune, and now they're making fortunes for themselves. Good luck to them. But I think Louis Tomlinson as well. His mum died quite young, didn't she? She had leukemia, and he had a younger sister he was very close to. She had a heart attack.
Wow.
Very unusual for a young person to have a heart attack. So she died as well. So that's I think he's had to grow up. Yeah, he's had to grow up quickly.
Golly, that's awful. Because a lot of those Irish boy bands who were run by, I can't remember his name, but he was a judge on...
Oh, he was a Louis, wasn't he? Yeah, Louis.
Yeah, he was, yeah. But they seem to come out of it all right.
Can't remember his name.
As well. And, you know, they do things like host the One Show and all that kind of stuff. But the one I remember that went terribly bad was the group called, was it E17 or something?
Yeah, there was an E17,
And the
one of them married Kerry Katona, I think.
I think you're absolutely right. Although I think
she's been a bit of a car crash all these years, hasn't she?
Well, that's a bit harsh. I think quite a lot of people married Kerry Katona. Didn't you marry?
What, you did as well?
No, I didn't. But anyway, look, I'm sure she's a lovely woman and all that kind of stuff. But the guy I'm thinking about, I can't remember his surname, but I think his first name was Brian or something.
Brian. I'm sure that's the one she married.
Is that right? Yeah.
It is Brian.
I think he's lead singer of E17, who you know, sort of came and went, if you see what I mean, a couple of years. But he managed to run himself over in his own Mercedes car. I don't know if you remember the story, but he was somehow manoeuvring his car. He opened the door, he fell out of the car, and the car ran over him.
Quite a lot of people have been killed doing that. You know, if they haven't put the handbrake on, maybe their car, the engine is running and they get out the car to go and open the gate or something like that. And then they jump back in the car to try and stop it because they can't. No. And they get trapped under the car. It's a horrific thing.
Pop stars have a habit of falling out of cars. George Michael once fell out of his own car on the M1, didn't he? Fell out.
Yeah, he did.
But there we go. Hello, everybody. I'm going to brighten up your day by telling you about Harry's, the fantastic shaving experience. Harry's are not just the super sharp razor company, people. They are much, much more. And you can start with a trial set that is absolutely free. You just have to pay for the delivery, okay? Now, in your trial pack, you get a unique engineered and weighted Harry's handle, a 5-blade cartridge complete with precision trimmer, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade carrier, or cover, I should say, if you're on the move, right? Also, a hydrating night lotion spray as an extra special gift. Now, absolutely everything you need is there for the smoothest of shaves, okay? Your trial set is packaged in beautiful aquamarine containers that let you know you're in for something special. The weighted handle makes you feel you're holding something more than just a razor. And believe me, you are. The trimmer blade makes it so easy to get to those hard-to-reach places. The foaming shave gel makes the blade skim across your face like a skater on an ice rink, okay? And after a couple of splashes of night lotion, you'll feel your skin positively invigorated and looking healthier and healthier. Now, Harry's products are put together with 0% sulfates or dyes and are alcohol-free, absolutely nothing to cause you any concern. Everything is crafted by experts who've devised invigorating formulas, and you will feel the difference no matter what your skincare goals are. So, folks, make sure to support our podcast, Life on Planet Porky, and start your own skincare journey by redeeming a free Harry's trial set. All you cover is £3.95 for delivery. So just head to harrys.com/porky and have your trial set and free night lotion delivered to your door. Let me give you that one more time. That's harrys.com/porky. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. We're having a good row around the issues which all you millions of listeners out there will like to explore and endure. Miss Jones, I'm not sure how much you know about one of the world's most mysterious crimes that's never been solved, but Lord Lucan, right, and just to refresh the memory of our millions of listeners, Lord Lucan has been accused, because it's now officially been sort of signed off in court, of trying to murder his nanny and maybe trying to murder his wife. And no, he did murder his nanny.
Well, he did murder the nanny, but he meant to murder his wife, is the theory, isn't it?
Thanks for telling me. The theory is he meant to murder his wife. He went down in the cellar. It was dark. He'd taken the bulb out the light. When a woman walked in, he clubbed her to death with a lead pipe. And then The wife appeared. He clubbed the nanny to death by mistake. The wife appeared. He tried to club her. They both ended up upstairs, believe it or not, with Lord Lucan bathing her head and saying, oh, that was a bit unfortunate, wasn't it? She then escaped from the house in Lower Belgrave Street and ran to a pub 150 yards down the road called the Plumber's Arms and rushed in and said, he's murdered the nanny. He's trying to kill me. And that was the start of the Lord Lucan saga, which to this day has never been solved. Because even today, as I talk to you, and the reason this has come up again is because of a story that was published in the papers 2 days ago, which I'll get to in a minute. But there have been more sightings of Lord Lucan possibly having grown to the age of 78 in Australia. I mean, it's one of those endearing crimes which fascinates us all.
I'm sure you remember Garth Gibbs.
Of course I do.
Garth Gibbs of the Daily Mirror, who famously spent more time not finding Lord Lucan in the most spectacular locations around the world. This was the triumph of journalism. Yeah. He said, and I quote, I have successfully not found him in more exotic spots than anybody else, from Cape Town to Macau to Hong Kong. Mm. Even in Green Turtle Bay in the Bahamas, where you can find anyone.
Yeah, that's right.
I thought this was a triumph of journalism. It really
it was. I knew Garth quite well, actually. I went on some foreign stories with him. And he used to ring up the news desk and then he'd tell them an absolutely load of nonsense story. And then he'd deliberately hold the phone away, you know, in a phone box somewhere, and say to an imaginary load of people around him, these guys don't believe me. They don't believe I've been working for 36 hours without food or drink. And then he'd go back to the phone and they'd say, oh, Garth, I'm sorry, we didn't know you'd been working so hard and that kind of stuff. Top comment. But just to get...
He was a rogue, wasn't he? But, I mean, how to go on holiday all over the world at somebody else's expense.
Oh,
just brilliant.
He used to walk up to his news editor, and I knew his news editor. I'm trying to remember his name now. I can see his face. And he'd sort of whisper in his ear, I've had another tip off about Lucan. I think we can find him this time. I know where he is. Oh, where is he? Well, this one's South Africa. You better get out there, but don't tell anybody. You know what I mean? So Garth would then go on like a 3-week holiday to Cape Town or something like that.
And go and see all his family because he came from there.
Exactly. And then report in every day, we're getting closer. We're getting closer. And all this kind of stuff, you know, and for some bizarre reason. But the reason it came up again was because the Daily Mail published a story saying they'd found a bit of new evidence after all these years, because I think this goes back about 40 years now, doesn't it? Or something like that.
Longer. It must have been 1970s.
Yeah.
And, of course, I tell you what else. He was pronounced officially dead by a High Court judge in 2016.
That's right, yeah. Absolutely. So that his son could inherit his title of Lord Lucan.
That's right.
So there is a modern-day
right.
Lord Lucan walking around. Imagine if you're like a hotel receptionist and this young, well, not young, he's probably middle-aged now, walks in and says, yes, I want a room for the night. Yeah, what's your name? Lord Lucan. I mean, the receptionist would probably then bring up a newspaper and say, you won't believe it, Lord Lucan just walked in. But his son is now allowed to carry the title of Lord Lucan.
Yes, but for that reason, he would walk into the hotel and announce himself as George Bingham.
Yes, that's right, yeah, which is his name before he became...
It's his proper name. He's the 8th Earl of Lucan, but he would say he's called George Bingham.
That's right. But anyway, the new clues are amazing. They say that in the Ford Corsair car that was left on the coast and then Lucan had disappeared, and the popular theory is he got on a cross-channel ferry and then threw himself off the ferry and was mashed up in the propellers of the ferry. And
it's nasty, isn't it?
Yeah, and if you jump off a ferry and the propellers at the back, you get sucked under the ferry and then you get mashed up by the propellers, I'm told. I've never tried it myself.
Obviously.
In the car, and I don't know how this has been a secret for like 42, 43 years, they found 3 cards from Lord Lucan's Monopoly set.
No, it was Cluedo. It was from the Cluedo game.
Cluedo, well done. Apparently he loved Cluedo. And the 3 were Colonel Mustard, so he is a character, the lead pipe, one of the murder weapons, and the hallway, which was one of the areas where the murder in Cluedo took place. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. But what's even more amazing is that it's taken all these years for this to come out.
I know. I just can't believe that anybody could have...
You know, the saddest thing was that the woman, the wife, was she called Veronica?
I think she was.
Trying to remember. She was estranged from her children for all those years.
Yes.
Because they didn't want to believe her version of the truth.
That's right.
So not only did she lose her husband, but she lost her kids as well.
That's right. And in the end, she died. And it's a bit harsh to say, but she definitely took to drink in later years. I used to speak to people who saw her.
Surprised she didn't do it sooner.
Yeah, well, I agree. The Plumber's Arms, by the way, in Lower Belgrave Street, it's one of my favourite pubs in London. It's quite close to Victoria Station. So
you took me there. You don't remember. Yes, we actually went there.
Yes, I do. I do remember. And all the pictures on the wall of Lord Lucan and all that, you know. So if I've finished a long day's work, you know, which, you know, obviously can start at sort of 6 o'clock in the morning and it's mid-afternoon, I think I'll pop into the Plumber's Arms just for the atmosphere there, you know, and the...
Fantastic pub. I really liked it. Yeah. We sank a load of gin and tonics in there.
We did indeed, absolutely. But it was well worth it. Now, Miss Jones, let me ask you this. Your father was one of the most famous football reporters of his age, Ken Jones.
And Thank you.
By the way, I don't know why, but I was sorting things out the other night and I came across one of my Everton scrapbooks, which I put together in 1970 when Everton won the Football League Championship. I cut out everything the next day, put it in a scrapbook. I came across it only the other day. I was sorting things out. And your father's byline is on one of the reports from the night that Everton won the Football League Championship in 1970. We beat West.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. Thank you.
It is. It's fantastic. Anyway, the point of this story is that 2 years after that, 1972, the most famous ever televised FA Cup goal was scored by a guy called Ronnie Radford. And what happened was Ronnie Radford was playing for Hereford, and Hereford were in the Southern League. And the Southern League was outside of the Football League, obviously. But they've drawn against Newcastle United. Newcastle United have always been a giant football club. They haven't won a hell of a lot, but they're a giant football club. We get very big crowds on Tyneside, obviously. And Hereford went there in the first game. They got a draw. So there was a replay down at, I think it's Edgar Road, Hereford's ground. And in the replay, Newcastle went 1-0 up. Malcolm McDonald was playing for Newcastle. But then... about 12 minutes from time, the ball dropped for Ronnie Radford on the most shocking pitch. In those days, pitches were like porridge, honest to God. There was no grass on them at that time of the year. You know, it's all mud and all that. And Ronnie Radford hit this ball and it screamed in for an equaliser, 1-1, and the fans invaded the pitch. And John Motson was doing his first ever commentary on an FA Cup match. And a lot of his expressions that he used for the rest of his career came into force that day. Oh, I say, you know, oh, look at that, and all that kind of stuff, which is typically John Motson. Anyway, Hereford then went on to score a winner a few minutes from time, and it was a very historic FA Cup occasion. But the reason I'm telling you this story is, sad to say, just a couple of days ago, Ronnie Radford passed away at the age of 78. But he really is a legendary figure in the history of what I regard as the world's greatest football competition, the FA Cup.
I did watch on YouTube for the goal, you know, just to see how spectacular it was. Yeah. But I can tell you another connection is that towards the end of his playing career, my father also played for Hereford.
Wow. Is that right? When it before he gave up football and became a journalist?
Yeah, when he was 24.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely remarkable, isn't it? I wonder if your dad was at that game. I suppose it's not really possible to find out.
Oh, how I wish I could ask him. Yeah. You have no idea.
Yeah, but, you know, it was a classic game because Hereford had got a draw at Newcastle. Could there be an FA Cup upset? And the amazing thing was, despite the fact that it was a replay, it happened on a Saturday because there'd been bad weather, had called games off. And so they used that Saturday to fill in the FA Cup replay rather than a league game because Newcastle's opponents couldn't play because of the weather. But anyway, look, I've loved the FA Cup all my life. I'm afraid the importance of it these days has diminished enormously. because of the Champions League and the importance of the Premier League and getting into the top four in the Premier League and all that kind of stuff, you know. But I mean, people tell these stories about, oh, you know, in class on a Monday after the FA Cup weekend, you'd take in your little radio and you'd hide under your desk and listen to the FA Cup draw to see who you'd got next and all that kind of stuff, you know. And that's true. It used to be absolutely magical, you know. And
oh, it was a major, major event in our childhood.
Yeah.
I only went to it a couple of times with my father. My mother used to go. We had
the cup final, the FA Cup final. Yes, yes, sure.
Yeah, we had these next door neighbours called Auntie Iris and Uncle Albert. They weren't really our auntie and uncle, but in those days you did call your next door neighbours auntie and uncle.
We called our next door neighbour Auntie Kath. Yeah, absolutely.
And they were from the north somewhere, can't remember where, Northumberland, I think.
Yeah.
And Auntie Iris used to cook a cup final lunch for all of us. There were four of us children, and she had two of her own. So there would be this, and it was always a sort of beef stew with this. They were like dumplings, but it was a crust over the entire top of the stew.
My mum used to call it suet pudding. My mum did exactly
the same. It was that. Pudding. And that was cup final lunch. Well, they called it cup final dinner.
Yeah.
And so we had cup final dinner, and then we'd all sit down to watch the match.
Yeah.
Terribly exciting.
Absolutely.
The community singing and the band, the brass band and all that. I used to cry watching the
FA Cup
final.
Abide with me. Though there be evening fall. I love that song. And a bloke in a white suit used to stand on a big bit of scaffolding in the middle of the pitch and sing that at the start of the cup final. I still sing it now.
Traditions are such wonderful things, aren't they? Yeah. And we've let so many of them go as a society and a nation.
I totally agree. Now, what do you think about that lovely lady, Katy Perry? Did you see what she said this week? She loves newspapers. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Katy Perry, one of the most famous, you know, sort of entertainers in the world, a young woman sticking up for newspapers when we all know the newspaper industry is in utter and total decline. But here's somebody coming forward in the public eye and saying, I love the rustle of the paper. I love the print on the pages. I love the pictures. Isn't that nice to see?
It is. I don't know how much of a fantasy that is. I mean, we've been saying for years, haven't we, that newspapers don't have much time left.
Mm.
What do you think? A decade at the outside?
I think we'll end up with about two. We used to have 16 titles in this country, right?
No, I mean, do we have 10 years left of actual physical newspapers?
No, I think in 10 years there'll be about two newspapers left.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I mean, the problem is that they follow the news now. They don't break the news because we used to get the news dropping through our letterbox in the morning. Now we've got it on television all night long, so we know exactly what's in the news before it arrives.
Yeah. Often newspapers, when they drop on your doormat now through the letterbox, they're about 12 hours out of date, aren't they?
Of course. So they're features rags, really, rather than newspapers.
You say rags, I still think there's a lot of quality newspapers around. And the other thing they can give,
I use the term.
Sure. They can give you analysis, you know what I mean? You know, you watch news all the time, this politician says that politician says that. And I buy newspapers these days to try and get the analysis and the inside thinking, what it's all like, because I'm not bright enough often to make up my own mind what's going on. So I need these newspaper greats, you know, who think this way. I mean, I would, you know, read The Guardian and The Telegraph on the same morning and get one perspective of a political view and then the other perspective and try and work it out, because I'm not bright enough to do it myself. But
oh, come on, yes, you are. You used to dictate to columnists what they should write about.
Sort of in a way. I don't know if you saw a piece by Jeremy Clarkson in the Sunday Times, but
I did.
I can't believe that he was so critical of James Corden. Did you see that?
Do you know what I think? A lot of people seem to think the same way about James Corden. I think a lot of people seem to feel the same way about Jeremy Clarkson.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I mean, they're both odious characters. I don't have a lot of admiration for James Corden.
I don't know either of them intimately. I've met both of them sort of briefly and fleetingly. I don't know enough about either of them. But for Clarkson to come out like that, and I mean, he said of James Corden that he was never a really nice person. Whenever I was in his company, he was pompous and above himself and all that. And this all comes from the fact that there's been a recent story that James Corden was very rude to a load of waiters in a restaurant in New York.
Yeah, and he has admitted it. Yeah. He has admitted that he spoke sharply to the waiter or the waitress, and he shouldn't have done. And he said it's because his wife is allergic to egg yolk.
Yes.
Now, I've never heard of anybody being allergic to egg yolk.
Normally.
You know, you're generally allergic to the whole egg, aren't
yes.
you?
Yes.
But she'd ordered an egg white omelette, which had turned up with a little bit of egg yolk in it, yeah. and he lost his temper.
Yeah.
What was she doing eating? Because the egg yolk has contact with the egg white.
Mm.
So if you're allergic to something, you tend not to have anything to do with it at all.
Yeah, no. It's...
So the story didn't really stack up for me. But I have heard from other sources. I've got a great friend yeah. called Clem Cattini.
Right.
He's a famous rock and roll drummer. He's drummed on 40 British number ones.
Wow.
He's worked with everybody you can think of. There was a film, I think it was called Telstar,
right.
about the life and times of Joe Meek.
Okay.
The producer and impresario. And James Corden played my friend Clem Cattini in that film.
Right.
And they had to have some sessions, some get-togethers, so that he could get a measure of Clem's personality and the way he speaks and, you know, some experiences, anecdotes, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Clem said he was a very unpleasant person.
Really?
And he just disregarded Clem, really. He didn't have any respect for who he is or what he's achieved.
Yeah, that's amazing. I met him once when he was doing a video with footballers. I think they're Manchester United footballers. And he was very funny, honestly, very sharp, wound up the footballers, you know, took the mickey out of David Beckham and Gary Neville and all that kind of stuff. Very, very good indeed. And, of course, a lot of us only know him through the, what was it called, the car karaoke stuff, you know?
Oh, carpool karaoke, yeah. Mm-hmm. But before that, there was Gavin and Stacey, which I thought was very clever.
Yeah.
A very cleverly, sharply observed series,
yes,
wasn't it?
It was.
However many series they were.
Wrote, didn't they? Yeah.
Yeah. And what was it? Jones. Ruth Jones, I think, co-wrote it
Ruth
with
Jones
him.
Is
and
right,
she,
yeah.
she, Ruth Jones, she was a character in the sitcom, I suppose
yeah,
you'd call it,
yeah.
as well. And I kind of always felt that he should have stopped there. You know, the carpool karaoke that he did for Children in Need, which was with George Michael,
yeah.
just after George Michael had gone out of prison.
Right.
And it was such a brilliantly observed sketch. Mm. The dialogue in it was so wonderful. Everyone was in shock
yeah.
that George Michael was even doing it.
And he laughed a lot, didn't he, George, when he took the Corden took the mickey out of him. George Michael laughed
yeah.
a lot, didn't he? Yeah.
But they were both in character in that piece. And
yeah.
it was so clever that I felt it should have stopped there. He shouldn't have gone on to make it a feature
yeah.
of his... what was it, Friday Night Live or whatever
yeah,
he did in,
sure,
in the States.
Sure.
Still doing it, I think. So then he starts doing it with McCartney and with Madonna and with Britney Spears.
Who can forget the McCartney one when McCartney ends up back in his local pub in Liverpool? It's been a hard day's night. I mean, that was just brilliant. I watched that to this day and it sends shivers down my spine, you know?
It really does. It brings a tear to your eye.
Yeah.
I've been in that pub quite a few times, actually.
Wow. Yeah.
It's opposite the Liverpool Philharmonic,
yes,
isn't
yeah.
it? On that big corner there. Lovely pub,
yeah.
beautiful old pub.
Yeah.
But I just sometimes think when something is so brilliant, you should just do it as a one-off.
Yeah. Well,
and not turn it into something. Nowadays, we seem so hell-bent on turning things into something.
Yeah. Well, it's very hard to say. If you've hit on something which is marvellous and it's successful, I suppose you're tempted to go on. One last thing, Miss Jones. I was quite shocked to read only today that Simon Le Bon has announced that one of the members of Duran Duran, there were three Taylors in Duran Duran, weren't there? And one of them was called Andy Taylor. Simon Le Bon claims he's got terminal cancer. I thought, A, wow, that's very shocking. And B, does Simon Le Bon have the right to announce that?
Well, Andy Taylor had announced it himself.
Already?
Sadly, yes, it is true. He's 61
yeah.
and it is the age. He's got stage 4 terminal prostate cancer. They just appeared, the band, at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction.
Oh, I see.
And Andy wasn't with them, but they spoke about it. And it is terribly sad.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
tragically, you know, this is what happens when men don't check themselves. Everybody,
I don't think you can check your prostate cancer, to be honest, Leslie-Ann. I think
you can go for your checkups, well, can't you?
For years and years, for decades, there's been this argument about it's not worth taking that test because it's so inaccurate, it might frighten you when you haven't got anything. I've heard that from doctors a dozen times, honestly.
Really? Okay. Yeah, anyway. I've got a couple of friends who are dealing with it at the moment. I never say battling cancer because I don't believe that we do battle cancer.
You can't
cancer.
Battle it. You've got it and you've just got to deal with it, you know?
Exactly.
No, you're absolutely right. Sorry to interrupt there. Yeah. Brave battle against cancer. Well, actually, you've only got an option when you've got cancer. Hope it goes away, you know?
Yeah, it's utter nonsense. I really loathe that phrase every time I hear it. Yeah. But I so wish Andy Taylor well and everybody else who's dealing with this terrible thing at this time. Very sad.
I totally agree. Right, okay, folks, that's it for another week here on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for having joined us. Thank you as well, Miss Jones, for your, you know, total input to this. And, you know, millions of our listeners will be enlightened by, once again, your inside information on all the big stories. Okay, folks, see you again this time next week. And he used to ring up the news desk and then he'd tell them an absolutely load of nonsense story. And then he'd deliberately hold the phone away, you know, in a phone box somewhere, and say to an imaginary load of people around him, "These guys don't believe me. They don't believe I've been working for 36 hours without food or drink." And then he'd go back to the phone and they'd say, "Oh, Garth, I'm sorry. We didn't know you'd been working so hard and that kind of stuff." Top comment. But just to
get... He was a rogue, wasn't he? But, I mean, how to go on holiday all over the world at somebody else's expense.
Oh,
just brilliant.
He used to walk up to his news editor, and I knew his news editor. I'm trying to remember his name now. I can see his face. And he'd sort of whisper in his ear, "I've had another tip off about Lucan. I think we can find him this time. I know where he is." "Oh, where is he?" "Well, this one's South Africa. You better get out there, but don't tell anybody." You know what I mean? So Garth would then go on like a 3-week holiday to Cape Town or something like that.
And go and see all his family because he came from there.
Exactly. And then report in every day, "We're getting closer. We're getting closer." He managed to run himself over in his own Mercedes car. I don't know if you remember the story, but he was somehow manoeuvring his car. He opened the door, he fell out of the car, and the car ran over him. The wave of heat that came into the plane blistered my face. It was so hot. It was about 42 degrees or something, you know.
It blisters your face.
It blistered my face, honest to God.